In his book, Past and Present, Scottish historian, critic, and social writer Thomas Carlyle created a most appropriate characterization of humanity's relationship with fire. Fire, Carlyle said, is the most useful of all servants and the most frightful of all masters. And so it goes. Warmed by the fireplace on a cold winter night, it's hard to imagine fire as an adversary. Yet when hundreds of thousands of acres of forest go up in flames, we cringe at the awesome power of fire to threaten both property and human life. So fire has become both friend and foe, ally and enemy through the ages. And fire becomes a most appropriate subject for the writers of Mind's Eye Radio to explore in poetry, prose, and song. I'm Greg Willard, your host for Kindling the Spirit of Fire on Mind's Eye Radio. In today's show, the Mind's Eye writers will look at history's most notorious conflagrations. We'll examine the phenomenon of fire from a very personal perspective, as well as from a scientific point of view. We'll see fire confer life and threaten death. You're invited to join us. We hope we'll be able to create a warm spot in your heart for kindling the spirit of fire.
As I read the fearful headlines and watched the terrifying pictures of what is now known as the Million Fire, the monster that has now burned over 1 million acres of the West, I was reminded again of the primacy of fire and why fire has come to symbolize both purification and destruction. In my personal life, the Promethean figures were the same as for most children, my mother and father. Fire seems to be part of my family's nature. Our mother's nature. My mother's fires were strong and arbitrary as the prairie wind. She set the red line creeping, challenging the fire of sunset while she tamped side ditches with a rake and hoe, clearing for whatever season was to come. My mother has suffered fire in her life, wily house fires that started in the night and ate the center from family albums as mice eat outward from the center of a loaf of bread. My mother wanted to be the boss of fire. My mother wanted to show she was stronger, and so each turn of season set the weeds to flame. My sisters and I would see signs of my mother's passion from far down the lane, the school bus crawling through low blue smoke, redolent of smoldering leaf, and we would descend, like Laura of the Little House books, to the wonder of our mother's face furled in motion. Raking the ditches, sometimes taking a notion to clean the house with an awesome pitching and punching of things into the burning barrel, with a douse of kerosene, she set flare anything she deemed extraneous or maybe dangerous. One time, my scribblings and poetry from a dresser drawer. Our mother seems a force of nature to us still, now tending our ailing dad, but aflame with willful passion to make things clean, to cauterize all wounds of time and incinerate the clutter of accumulation, human and otherwise. If she could, I know she would be folding a bandana over nose and mouth, shielding eyes, and burning the side ditches even now, sharing the duplicity and grace of fire. This is Norma Gay Pruitt, who doesn't want to set the world on fire, but would like to illuminate a little corner of it for Mind's Eye Radio.
Writer Sharon Van Sluis dissects the moral and ethical implications of fire.
Justice is a human abstraction with no true connection to the natural world. The weather is not just or unjust. The world of the hawk and coyote is not just or unjust, it just is. This may seem obvious to most adults, but it was not so long ago that humans intertwined their lives tightly with the world. An eclipse was portentous, a particular thunderclap meaningful, a flood or a fire a judgment or punishment. We have become more logical and scientific. It seems, though, that most children still live in that aboriginal state before thought was disconnected from the world. For kids, everything can still be connected and huge, meaningful and mysterious, at least for a while, as it was very briefly for me about 30 years ago. My sisters, Anna and Cassie, and I all rode the bus to school each day. We lived in the country, and the route was long and wide-ranging, 30 minutes each morning, 30 minutes each afternoon. It had been tedious, though bearable, for us, until that year Anna got sick. Anna got sick when she was 6, and in the next year developed epileptic seizures. Sometimes full-blown grand mal, the convulsions on the school hall floor, the frantic calls by the teachers to my parents. Or sometimes they were just spells. Her eyes would glaze over. She'd stare off, unblinking, for several minutes as if she'd simply left her body there as a placeholder. This happened at home, at school. It happened everywhere. Children being what they can be, especially small boys, that is, intensely observant of any nonconformity, compulsively reactive and barbaric, Anna was soon labeled spaz attack by the boys on the bus. It was only a few, but they were insistent. The third and fourth grade boys, Randy, Gary, and Dale, and Brian, would taunt her, "Hey, spaz attack! Hey, roll your eyes back, spaz attack!" Eventually, because we were sisters and the world is not just, we were all labeled spaz attack, though Cassie and I were completely healthy. The bus driver, Mr. Bruno, did nothing to stop it. Occasionally I would see his eyes glance back in the rearview mirror, probably to check for actual physical disturbance. But he did nothing. Anna, Cassie, and I would sit very still in the bus seat, sometimes all of us in one seat, and stare straight ahead as the names swirled around us. We sat stoically, becoming statues, trying not to cry, counting the stops to the end of the route. We knew that no one would stop them. It was just boys, just the way they are, just names, sticks and stones, and all that. The sticks and stones can break my bones line came from my mother. She probably believed it helped. Names can never hurt me. Is that what she thought? I began then, at the age of 9, to doubt my mother's wisdom. The turn-the-other-cheek business seemed skewed, too. Yes, I was 9, and beginning to think that the God that my parents so vigorously promoted to us, if he existed at all, really had a lot of explaining to do. Some new kid showed up on the bus that winter I turned 9. Andrew, Peter, and Gustav Ray. They were in first, second, and third grades and lived in a ramshackle rental farmhouse. There were, we heard, 4 more brothers and sisters still at home, too young for school. A big, poor family in a drafty, old, peeling farmhouse. On the bus, Andrew and Peter sat down together, quiet and furtive as rodents, not Gustav. Gustav was in my grade. He was a pale, dirty child, with a short, bad haircut and a very round face. He wanted to be part of a group, that was clear. I could see the slavish eagerness in his eyes when he sat next to Randy and Gary. "They let me sit down," I saw him thinking. "They like me." Pathetic. It was only a few days before he was initiated into the spaz attack regimen. Gary and Randy, Dale and Brian urged him on, sending him up the aisle to tweak our coats and yell spaz attack at us before rushing back to the lair of the back seats. Such a chicken, I thought, but said nothing. I did not react. There was no way to stop it. The adults had abandoned us with silly sayings or sidelong glances. There was no way to eke any justice out of the situation except to deny our tormentors our tears, the reactions they craved. And perhaps it was this stoicism that actually provoked the next round. After a spate of agitated whispering behind the seats, Gustav rushed up behind us and with enormous force for such a puny kid, spat on my sister Anna. Then rushed back yelling, "Spaz attack!" A gob of white, frothy spit clung to the back of Anna's red wool beret. The boys in the back giggled hysterically. "Don't," I whispered, as Anna started to turn, her eyes brimming. I removed her beret and carefully daubed the spit off with my pocket tissues. Cassie was starting to get impatient, too. "But they can't!" "Don't," I said under my breath. There was more frantic whispering from the back. Gustav began another run up the aisle. Just as he neared our seat and reached to tweak Anna's jacket, I swiftly turned and grabbed his wrist hard. I was a small girl, but strong. In softball, I couldn't catch worth a nickel, but I had strong arms and regularly hit home runs. I grabbed his wrist. It was narrow and pale. My hand encircled it, my fingers touching around it. A chicken bone wrist. Gustav stopped, wiggled to break free, but there was no chance of that. "You won't do that again, Gustav Ray," I said deliberately, looking directly in his eyes. "Go sit down. Sit down and stay," I said, as though he were a very, very bad dog. His pale eyes widened in acute surprise and a glimmer of terror. It had not occurred to him that we were humans, that we would speak right to him. He managed a little strangled animal squeal like a piglet caught between fence slats, raced back to his seat, and cowered down. The taunting stopped for the rest of the ride home. The next day was very cold and clear after a sub-zero night. When we got on the bus, we knew something had changed. It was much quieter. The bus was half full and people were talking as usual, but it was subdued talk, as though the bus had become Sunday school. After we sat down, one girl, Susan Smith, a fifth grader who would never have spoken to us normally, turned in her seat. She was nearly bursting with news. "Do you know what happened? Do you know?" She didn't wait for me to answer. "The house burned down. Some space heater or something. That farmhouse and all those kids died in it. Gustav, that kid you grabbed yesterday, and all of them burned up. Wow." The house was on the route, a few miles away. Everyone crowded to the windows to see. Mr. Bruno slowed the bus a little. What was left of the farmhouse was black and smoldering. The second floor was gone, fallen into the dark, open skeleton of the first. Pieces of the roof had fallen into the kitchen. There was a blackened refrigerator, twisted kitchen chairs. A small, scorched, striped mattress exhaled smoke on the yard. From every horizontal surface of the house remains, long icicles hung down. The fire truck's water frozen on what was left. There was a hard, sharp smell that came into the closed bus like lots of old wet cigarettes, like a big old ashtray. There were no bodies, of course, but I imagined them. I think everyone imagined them. Gustav on that smoking mattress. Gustav Ray and his six brothers and sisters were all burned up. His skinny wrist had been in my hand the day before. I had told him, "You won't do that again." And now his wrist was gone. It was dead. He was dead. I knew I should feel bad, but I felt instead a kind of astonishment that someone would just disappear. But I also felt for a moment, and I was very wary of embracing it, a kind of satisfaction, relief even. For a moment, there seemed to be some kind of justice in the world. The fire was just, it seemed, for a moment. I couldn't hold the thought for long, though. I was 9. Already moving from that aboriginal state into human abstraction and rationality. For if this fire really were justice, it was a very scary thing. It was excessive and capricious, the act of a lunatic god. Perhaps Gary and Randy and the others should be hit by lightning, I thought. But Gustav Ray, the follower, the obsequious wimp, and his whole family burned to death? That wasn't justice. Did Anna get sick because she was bad? No, I decided. It just happened. And so I spent the next few bus rides, mercifully free of any taunting, for I did nothing to dispel the clear notion floating in the air that I had somehow willed the fire to happen. I spent the next few days contemplating the fire and coming to the realization that the world was not just or unjust, that the fire simply was, like a storm, like a flood. It had effects, but it was not meaningful. I came to see that real justice required close attention, thought, and action, and that there was justice in my grabbing Gustav's wrist, my saying no to him without calling him names and stooping to fight, my wielding language as a tool and not as a weapon. Young and tentative as I was, what was flickering in me at 9 was that abstract sort of fire, the fire of the mind. Not that fierce, but random and accidental fire that consumed Gustav Ray and his family, but instead the intellectual fire that has kindled and fed ideas of justice from the moment people realized that the shadow passing over the sun would simply pass, with or without the human element, and they turned instead to what they could actively choose to do to better their lives. It is that fire of rational thought that burns in a wholly constructed, wholly abstract and rational human realm. I had caught that spark, and stepped over into that realm. This is Sharon Van Sloos for Mind's Eye Radio.
For writer Jeff Black, fire is a comforting companion on a dark night in the woods. In his three short essays, Fire Number 2, In Ode to Fire, and This Ritual, Black takes us into the forest to reveal his personal connection to fire and the benefits it confers upon us.
I must say, if there's one thing I can do really good, is build really good fires. I can build a fire on a winter's day when everything's wet. And come out here where there's only one dead tree. Keep a fire going for hours. Nice, even, crackling, warm fire.
See? On the first day of spring, the vernal equinox, I do this ritual. I go out into the closest woods to me, depending on where I live, and I start the first fire of the new season.
That's a tough one.
I'm not really sure why I do this exactly, or at that, how many years I've been doing it. Maybe 10 or 12 now, but it's like my gift. My welcoming of warmer weather. My confirmation of the fact that I made it through another long, cold winter. My vernal equinox celebratory fire is very ritualistic, actually. I gather small sticks and twigs and pine needles from all four directions of the fire pit. Gather from the north, then from the east, from the south, and then the west. I create a little piece of art in the center. And I always do my best to create the first fire as pure as possible. No paper and matches. Some of the past year's fires were not easy to start, especially the ones created in the northern states. With the melting snow and wet grounds, my ritual a few times took hours to get started. But I never quit. And this all ties perfectly into the meaning of my little ritual. Because to me, the first day of spring is the new year. That's where it all begins for me. And the effort I put into making that first fire of the new year reminds me that I must keep trying. Persevere. Work harder. Knowing the reward which comes from it. It reminds me to keep the spirit free of senseless traffic. To keep the mind burning, bright, and warm. You, oh warm one, who had most likely everything to do with our ongoing existence. You who kept the body warm and the food cooked in days of old where there was no convenience of central heat. You who cleansed the spirits of those who occupied the land known as America before its rape by the settlers. You who retained warmth to the souls of the weary on a long winter's hunt for food and shelter. You whose origin we do not even have written record of. An ode to you, O powerful and dangerous one, which only the respectful and honest now reap the benefit of. You. It's to you, your life, within yourself, whom I relentlessly tend to give me exercise and heat and light and relaxation. You who, though not necessary, cooks my meal and keeps my mind occupied in times of dismay. You who I escape to and secretly wish for the times when you were all humankind had to survive. Here's to you.
How do things burn? What happens to transform a material object into a heap of smoldering ash? Writer Elena Tabachnik takes a close look at the process through which science has been able to uncover the secrets of fire and some revelations of the human spirit to which fire is connected.
I lived with Karen for 5 years. She was a great housemate. Relaxed, cheerful, and able to fix a toilet or cook bread with equal ease. Yet somehow, the succession of third persons in our house was always a disaster. Not for Karen. It was always me and that other who were burning. Karen was our mediator, as she got along well with us both. But despite her presence, every little irritation between me and our third soon became a consuming conflagration. There was Lillian, then Ginny, and finally Deb. I can't remember now what all our great fights were over. Details, insignificant differences in lifestyle, things that ought to have been easy to talk about and compromise over. One day, Karen and I sat on the porch swing, iced tea with lemon cooling our throats, while our bare feet pushed against the porch rail in gentle unison. We had just been through one more house ruckus. I lamented our constant lack of peace and thanked Karen for her fruitless efforts of mediation. "Oh, that's okay," Karen said as I stammered through apologetic compliments on her UN-like work. "I'm used to it. In my family, everyone else fights, and I'm the go-between. It's always been that way, as long as I can remember." Suddenly, my point of view shifted. Everyone around Karen always fights, but she remains calm? Was she really gifted with incredible serenity in the presence of human flame? Or could she actually be the reason, the secret ingredient, the catalyst that drives ordinary heat into a devastating blaze? It so happened I was working on the history of chemistry. My housemate Karen sounded just like the mysterious heir of fire. It seems to have been a widespread human idea that matter is made of a few parts. Most cultures had some form of it, like the earth, air, fire, water combo, or the modern idea that combinations of atoms make all the stuff there is. In those theories, one thing can be changed into another by adding or taking away parts through chemical processes, like burning. But what is burning? Most of us breeze right by this mystery if we think about it at all, assuming it's tidily explained in a book somewhere, and we could look it up if we wanted to, but yawn, why bother? Yet this is a vital question about the nature of matter. Someone had to answer it in the first place, with no book to look in except that written in fire itself. Imagine a branch cut from a tree. What is happening as brown-green flesh sputters into red and yellow flame? What is that radiance building deep in the center, held only by a blackened memory of once strong wood? What is the heat, released in waves so thick they can be seen as well as felt, although they have no color or standing form? And finally, when the heat is finished, having consumed sap, flesh, even itself, what is this flimsy corpse which touched, collapses to a little black powder. What is burning? By what means has all that is moist and cold been converted into hot, dry dust? Pondering these questions in 1697, Ernst Stahl wrote that burning materials give off a substance called phlogiston, from the Greek for fire. All very well, but that raises a new question. If phlogiston goes out of wood, or candle wax, or oil, or animal flesh, it has to go into something else. Some substance desperately lacking in phlogiston that promotes burning by drawing the phlogiston out. 100 years later, in the 1770s, Carl Steele, a Swede, first solved the mystery. He identified a kind of air that promotes fierce burning. He called it fire air. However, Steele was not particularly fiery himself and sat on his discovery for over 5 years. Meanwhile, in England, Joseph Priestley also solved the mystery, identifying the same air. This was it, a substance so parched for phlogiston it drained living materials dry, leaving mere ash. Fire air, the breath of fire. We now call it oxygen. Modern chemistry says that oxygen promotes fire because it is hungry for electrons, not phlogiston. But phlogiston or electrons, oxygen has the same effect on others. It doesn't burn itself, but in its presence, a little heat becomes a great conflagration and everything is consumed. Priestley was as incendiary as his discovery, not with his science. That was of no interest to mobs of common folk. It was his liberal, Unitarian religious views that flamed his neighbors. He commonly ranted against cherished orthodoxy, and in response, a mob stormed his home and destroyed it. Although Priestley escaped across the Atlantic into religious-tolerant Pennsylvania. Of course, that's not so bad as what happened to Lavoisier, a French chemist who doubted the phlogiston theory, and by careful weighing showed that there is no phlogiston, only the matter that burns, the ash and oxygen. The French Revolution mobs didn't simply run him off, however. They removed his head. Although they were maddened by his privileged position as a tax collector, not his oxygen theory. But it is obviously dangerous stuff, oxygen, not to be lightly toyed with, despite its metaphorical reputation for supporting growth and harmony. They were great inflamers, Priestley and Lavoisier, like oxygen, like my housemate, Karen. After our conversation on the porch, I started to pay attention. It was true. Her mediation, although sincere, always seemed to make us angrier and less tolerant of each other. It was only after she acted as our go-between, soothing each of us in private, that our little annoyance with each other became insulted fury. It wasn't too long after the next big explosion that I decided to move. I still liked Karen a lot. I just didn't know how to live in such a dangerous, fiery air. This is Elena Tabachnik for Mind's Eye Radio.
Comb your hair and paint and powder. You act proud and I'll act prouder. You sing loud and I'll sing louder. Tonight we're setting the woods on fire.
This is Kindling the Spirit of Fire on Mind's Eye Radio. Coming up in the next part of our show, we'll recall a great fire disaster of the past, consider how future wildfires might be prevented, and look back to a child's view of a fire whose flames touched terribly close to home. I'm Greg Willard. We'll be back in a moment. The Great Peshtigo Fire, near Green Bay, Wisconsin, started on October 8, 1871, the same day as the better-known Chicago Fire. When it was over, 2,400 square miles were destroyed. It was the deadliest forest fire in American history. 1,500 people died, 5 times more fatalities than the Chicago fire. The following is an excerpt from The Great Peshtigo Fire, an Eyewitness Account by Father Peter Pernin, a French missionary priest. The air was no longer fit to breathe, full, as it was, of sand, dust, ashes, cinders, sparks, smoke, and fire. It was almost impossible to keep one's eyes unclosed, to distinguish the road, or to recognize people, though the way was crowded with pedestrians as well as vehicles, crossing and crashing against each other in the general flight. Some were hastening towards the river, others from it, whilst all were struggling alike in the grasp of the hurricane. 1,000 discordant, deafening noises rose on the air together. The neighing of horses, falling of chimneys, crashing of uprooted trees, roaring and whistling of the wind, crackling of fire as it ran with lightning-like rapidity from house to house, all sounds were there save that of the human voice. People seemed stricken dumb by terror. They jostled each other without exchanging look, word, or counsel. The silence of the tomb reigned among the living. Nature alone lifted up its voice and spoke. Once in water up to our necks, I thought I would at least be safe from fire, but it was not so. The flames darted over the river as they did over land. The air was full of them, or rather the air itself was on fire. Our heads were in continual danger. It was only by throwing water constantly over them and our faces and beating the river with our hands that we kept the flames at bay. Not far from me, a woman was supporting herself in the water by means of a log. After a time, a cow swam past. There were more than a dozen of these animals in the river, impelled thither by instinct, and they succeeded in saving their lives. The first mentioned one overturned in its passage the log to which the woman was clinging, and she disappeared into the water. I thought her lost, but soon saw her emerge from it, holding on with one hand to the horns of the cow and throwing water on her head with the other. How long she remained in this critical position, I know not, but I was told later that the animal had swam safely to the shore, bearing her human burden safely with her, and what threatened to bring destruction to the woman had proved the means of her salvation. At the moment I was entering the river, another woman, terrified and breathless, reached its bank. She was leading one child by the hand and held pressed to her breast what appeared to be another, enveloped in a roll of disordered linen, evidently caught up in haste. Oh, horror! On opening these wraps, to look on the face of her child, it was not there. That was a selection from The Great Peshtigo Fire, an Eyewitness Account by Father Peter Pernin, a French missionary priest. Fire can be a threat, an intrusion, and a revelation, all at the same time. Those multiple roles are demonstrated in Evie Thompson's story of a couple rudely interrupted by fire during a most private moment.
My boyfriend's hand is inside my blouse. His fingers, so silky, so smooth. His mouth is on mine. Sean murmurs into my hair, "You are so beautiful." And, as always, he makes me feel very special. Enough so that my painful memory of that slut he slept with fades. On the landing outside his apartment, some of the other students are yelling. I can't hear what. "Just ignore it," Sean says. He kisses and licks the back of my neck. He knows that excites me beyond all reason. A sharp blat of noise, the smoke alarm, goes on and on. "Just take no notice," he breathes against my throat. His fingers slip under my bra strap and gently, oh so gently, slide it off my shoulder. He unbuckles his belt and unzips, and I whip off my panties. He's on top of me on the bed, and now we hear the sirens. John flings himself from the bed, zipping as he goes, and is out of the back door before I know what has happened. I shove bare feet into shoes, arms into my jacket, grab panties off the foot of the bed, and stuff them into my jacket pocket. There's a porch across the back of the old house at all four stories, with stairs running down to the ground. We are on the third floor. I fumble at the buttons on my blouse. A loud siren winds down outside. Red and blue lights are flashing in the windows. There are more sirens in the distance, headed this way. I smell smoke, and I stop buttoning. Better get out. I dash across the back porch to the stairs. But before I can start down, I hear barking and whining behind me. I turn and see Posy, the neighbor's dog, her face pressed against the window, and the neighbor is out. I met him on the stairs as I came in. I go back and pull open the door. Posy rushes at me. Down, Posy, down! I manhandle her to the stairs and give a nudge. Terrified of steps, Posy descends slowly, step by step. An under-exercised and over-fat dog. And I can't get past her. Below me, firemen are hooking up hoses. This is a corner house, and across the street, a group of onlookers mills about. A brisk wind blows out of the north, and I feel the breeze up under my skirt, all the way to my waist. Thank God it's a narrow skirt, and these are wood stairs and not the open steel grate fire escapes, so that anyone who looked up could see way past France. Posy and I have reached the last flight of stairs. Firemen squeeze past us on their way up. And then we are down at last. I see Sean. He is with a bunch of his buddies, and he is gesturing at his fly, a zipping-up movement. They all laugh. Then they see me and look away, but one elbows his neighbor, and they both giggle. Suddenly my face is burning, and I am shaking with anger. Overhead, smoke is billowing out of the roof, where the firemen are venting the fire. I want to go over and bloody Sean's nose, but he is so much bigger than me I'd probably fail, and he and his friends would have another good laugh. Something wet and warm wipes my hand, over and over. I look down, and there is Posy, licking my fingers and looking up at me. I wonder who takes care of pets at a fire. Oh, Posy, what am I going to do with you? Posy wags her tail tentatively. Oh, well, you might as well come home with me. I'll bring you back later. We start off. I am feeling humiliated and angry. But in the background, the regular clicking of Posy's nails on the sidewalk is, somehow, comforting. This is Evie Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
There's been a fire at the high school. Everyone is talking about it now. No one sure just how it started. The volunteers have already put it out. Janitor Ned, oh, the alarm, he was the first one to spot the flames. There's been a fire at the high school. There must be someone we can blame. There's been a fire at the high school. It didn't start in the science class. Whenever an experiment goes wrong, Mr. Benson is quick to act. Wasn't a Bunsen burner, they were just dissecting frogs. There's been a fire at the high school, the science class did nothing wrong. There's been a fire at the high school. Miss Rulo was out for the day. Her class was taught by a substitute. It's ironic that it happened that way, because Miss Rulo loved those fire drills, the students filing out in a single line. There's been a fire at the high school. Miss Rulo missed the real thing this time. kids all stood around. Was it a real alarm or just another test? Was it much of a fire? But they sent them home for the rest of the day. Been a fire at the high school. It started in the teacher's lounge, where smoking is not allowed. But some evidence was found. The substitute was last seen there, and she seemed a little afraid. There's been a fire at the high school. Been a fire at the high school. Been a fire at the high school.
This is Lynn Patrick Smith with Janet Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
Fire Rescue.
Poet Kathy Miner.
Today they are burning the prairie, spreading a blanket of fire over last year's Blue Stem and Blazing Star, wrapping it about the bases of the bur oaks, smoothing it over knoll and flatland, tucking its edges in carefully, and squaring the corners. It is a kindness, not a punishment, this act. Prairie plants are rooted so deep they laugh at flames, and the soft, black coverlet left behind will warm in the waxing sunshine and nurture new green life beneath its comforting darkness. Come back in a week. You'll see. For Mind's Eye Radio, I'm Kathy Miner.
Poet Esther Cameron regards fire with a good deal of concern. In addressing the subject, Cameron recalls a Jewish holiday where fire plays a central role in the festivities.
This poem combines two memories. One of them is from the Jewish holiday of Lag BaOmer, which falls halfway between Passover and Shavuot, or Pentecost, which commemorates the giving of the law. On Lag BaOmer, it's customary to light bonfires, and so the first part of the poem is about seeing a bonfire in Jerusalem. And this is combined with a memory of canoeing on a northern marsh and seeing a white water lily. At Lag BaOmer in Jerusalem, a bonfire they had built up wide and tall drew me near, nearer, like a house of flame, till the heat stood against me like a wall I could not pass. A limit of my being gave notice, as when pain and fault and fear make plain the bounds without which I am nothing, the strict and shrinking smallness of my sphere. Afloat upon a northern marsh I saw white petals gleaming round a saffron heart, and comprehended in the self-same awe all that would tear the ivory globe apart, which seemed to trust as strength, in form's strange pride, the fragile spell that cloaks the frail untried. I'm Esther Cameron for Mind's Eye Radio.
And what of the origins of fire? The ancient Greeks credited the demigod Prometheus with stealing fire from Zeus and bringing it to Earth to benefit us mortals. But what of Prometheus? What would he say if he could tell his story? Writer Dick Radke speculates on what happened next.
Yeah, yeah, Dad. I know you're there, but hey, what more can you do to me? I'm going to talk to the mortals as much as I like. It's me, Prometheus. It all started with a practical joke, if you can believe that. It was coming up on the old man's birthday. That'd be Zeus. And I thought I'd put one over on him. He loves his nip of port in the evenings and drinks it from the fanciest decanters you can imagine. So what I did was to rig up two gifts for his birthday this year. I got a hold of a bottle of 20-year-old high-end stuff and a second bottle of downright disgusting rotgut. Then I switched bottles. I wanted to see the look on his face when he took a good long pull of the cheap stuff by mistake. But the old man is pretty shrewd. Somehow he saw through my plan and got his dander up that I'd try to trick him that way. There followed one of his temper tantrums, and I was grounded for several centuries. Around him, you have to be well grounded, which only made me more determined to have my own way. I began giving gifts to the mortals against Pop's orders. He wanted the mortals to live like primitives until they eventually died off. I thought they were very cool beings and decided to give them gifts, telling the seasons by the stars, numbers, that sort of thing. I also gave them healing drugs, signs in the sky, precious metals, and art. Yeah, art. But my best gift was fire. I stole fire from Zeus and gave it to the mortals to light their caves. Well, that changed everything. Pretty soon they had culture and literacy and MTV in the land around Olympus. I was pretty darn proud of myself until Zeus found out I was the one who nicked his fire and had me chained to this mountain until he gets over his hissy fit. Meanwhile, every day he sends his pet eagle to snack on my liver. Being immortal, every night I heal up so that damn eagle can start all over again at dawn. Which goes to prove the truth of the saying, no good deed goes unpunished. I do the mortals a favor, a big favor, and look what I get for it. Chained to this rock with that damn vulture picking at my body every blessed day. In some ways, though, it was worth it. Look at what the mortals have now. Campfires and hot meals. Why, before a fire, you'd have a tough time scaring up something as simple as a fried egg or even a hot cup of coffee. And it was all my doing. Now you've got stoves and furnaces. Try keeping warm in the middle of winter without fire. Which brings me to my point. I did you mortals a favor, and now I'm asking for one in return. There must be someone out there in Radioland who's willing to do a good turn for a god who went way out of his way for the human race. Please, come up here and rescue me from this stupid bird. To get here, take the number 29 bus out of Athens to the end of the line. Cross the Aegean and Black Seas, then trek 1,500 miles to the foot of my mountain. You'll see me hanging up here in the Caucasus like a side of beef in a meat locker on the face of the cliff. Bring a bolt cutter. These chains are tough. And make it snappy. Here comes that damn bird again. This is Prometheus Bound, waiting to be unbound for Mind's Eye Radio.
For some of us, fire can be a particularly harrowing memory. Writer Fran Rawl remembers how one such fire engulfed her family and left an indelible impression upon her mind.
When I was a child in Oregon, 4,000 feet up in timber country, fire meant having a wood-burning furnace in the basement with a big grate upstairs in the living room to dress over in the winter weather. It meant watching my mother singe pin feathers over an open stove eye, chicken in one hand, newspaper torch in the other, black flakes falling harmlessly downward. It meant seeing the bark burner at the mill spitting firework sparks through a wire cone over the tall cylinder. It seemed to burn night and day. It meant me splitting blocks of pitch pine into kindling with a small hatchet. It meant lukewarm baths in the summer when Mom cooked on the electric stove. That all changed when a neighbor pounded on the door while we were eating supper one evening.
Harry, your mill's on fire!
My dad, a sawyer at that mill, the Iwana Box Factory, leaped up from the table instantly and took off running out the front door, still in his carpet slippers. I don't know if he ran the whole distance, about 2 miles, or whether someone going to the fire picked him up. Being a sawyer was an elite job in the mill. I still have a little round gold saw I found in my mother's jewelry, an advertisement for the Simmons Saw Company. A trip to the mill to see my father working made an indelible impression on me. A sawyer sits on a huge black piece of machinery called a carriage, which runs the log past a fixed rotating saw, which rips off a slice. At the end of the run, he kicks a foot pedal, which throws the log up and around a quarter turn. It falls back and is gripped by the huge jaws, ready to thunder back to be sliced again. The first pieces are bark, destined for the burner. When the log is squared off, cutting the actual lumber commences. The noise is horrendous, and the very air shakes. I am amazed I was able to see this, as sawmills are dangerous places. After we finished supper, someone gave my mother, my sister, and me a ride to see the fire. Oddly enough, I don't remember seeing the blaze, just clambering to the top of a big crisscross stack of splintery lumber drying in the mill yard. I seem to remember my dad coming home wet and exhausted, and I'm sure he went to work the next morning to help clean up and see if he still had a job. And it was this job he was demoted from when he cut off an index finger at the mill later. Since he wasn't fired outright, he could not collect any of the unemployment which Roosevelt's New Deal had brought into being. He sawed for out-of-town mills the rest of his working days, coming home weekends. I don't know if he made much more money doing this, as there was room and board to pay. Probably it was pride and the fact that he could still do this demanding job which made it all worthwhile. It must have been then that we bought the green 34 Chevy, in which Mom drove him back and forth to his job, and which I learned to drive years later. This is Fran Rawl, still smoldering for Mind's Eye Radio.
The symbol for love is usually depicted as flame, or a heart on fire. Louise Mancuso touches on this when speaking about love as fire in the lives of the saints, then brings us back to earth with her own experience of real fire.
The mystics of the Catholic Church are often referred to as being on fire or consumed with love of God, who is all and in every living thing. 12th century mystic Hildegard of Bingen believed this most likely as a result of a vision she had in which God reveals himself that way. I, the fiery life of divine essence, am aflame beyond the beauty of the meadows, she wrote. I gleam in the waters, I burn in the sun, moon, and the stars, with every breeze as with invisible light that contains everything. I awaken everything to life. I am the breeze that nurtures all things green. I encourage blossoms to flourish with ripening fruits. I am rain coming from the dew that causes the grasses to laugh with the joy of life. Of her very first vision, she wrote, and it came to pass when I was 42 years and 7 months old that the heavens were opened and a blinding light of exceptional brilliance flowed through my entire brain. It kindled my whole heart and breast like a flame, not burning, but warming. And suddenly I understood the meaning of the expositions of the Psalter, the Evangelists, and other books of the Old and New Testaments. It is said by some theorists that Hildegard suffered from migraines, and that this is what caused the visions. If this is so, what then caused the instantaneous understanding? Saints John of the Cross and Catherine of Siena were said to have hearts that were on fire with love of God. And Saint Augustine writes in his Confessions, O love, who are forever aflame and are never extinguished, O charity, my God, set me aflame. But perhaps the saint who best epitomizes this mystical state is Teresa of Avila, who describes one of her most meaningful visions in this way. The angel was small, and his face was so aflame that he seemed to be one of those very sublime angels that appear to be all fire. I saw in his hands a large golden dart, and at the end of the iron tip there appeared to be a little fire. It seemed to me this angel plunged the dart several times into my heart, and that it reached deep within me and left me all on fire with love of God. The Holy Spirit, who is called the Spirit of Love that we know from the Gospels, appeared in the form of tongues of fire, alighting on the heads of the apostles and others, gathered in fear in the upper room after Christ's death and resurrection. The Spirit, the fire, helped them go forth into the world unafraid. One could spend years and even a lifetime researching information that has to do with fire as metaphor. But I'll sum up my small effort here by coming a little more back to earth and telling you about the time I was living in Hawaii and staying in a treehouse built by an ex-soldier who had served in Korea. The house was in a huge tree that was situated past the pineapple and cane fields on Oahu, and Keith let me use the abode as my upper room, you might say, hiding out while I finished typing a final draft of a novel that had taken me years to write. I left my meager belongings at a friend's and was jeeped into the interior, where wild hogs and other such creatures made their home. I had supplies for a month, I had my typewriter, I had paper, I had a place and a block of time in which to do my work unencumbered. I smoked one of Keith's cigarillos on the veranda each evening, a reward for a day spent at the typewriter. Sometimes I took a taste of his peach brandy to help prepare me for sleep. One night, about 2 weeks into my stay, I was awakened by the sound of trucks and shouts of male voices that seemed not all that far from the treehouse. Were these teenagers from town using the cane field for a drunken party? Would they spy the treehouse and investigate it? I certainly would have no way of defending myself if someone decided to do me harm. Working up a cold sweat of fear, I debated my next move when all of a sudden I saw distant flames mirroring themselves in the small windows of the treehouse. Now what? Did they decide to make a fire that got out of hand and was now spreading through the fields? Would the fire reach the treehouse? Did I need to try and make a run for it in the pitch-black darkness with no place to go? When the shouts and laughter of the men continued, I came to the conclusion there was no danger or they would have left, and certainly would not have been laughing. Nevertheless, I spent an uneasy rest of the night praying the treehouse would not be discovered. I decided to lay low for the next few days, concentrating on getting the manuscript done. When the fourth day dawned, I alighted from the treehouse and set out to survey the surrounding area. The pungent odor of dry red earth on the pathway rose as incense with each step, but there was no change in the lay of the land until I came to what should have been one of my landmarks. The entire cane field had been raised to level land. A lone worker, sitting in a small tractor making its lazy way around the field, spied me. He looked surprised to see another person there, especially, I imagine, a woman. I ducked out of sight and made my way back to the treehouse. I later learned that setting the cane fields on fire was part of the harvesting process, where the dross was burned off, making for easier cutting of the cane. 5 days later, I slid the typewriter under the bed, made a backpack out of Keith's red flannel shirt in which I wrapped the finished manuscript, and left the treehouse for good. A song by the group ABBA that was popular at the time made its way into my head, and I found myself singing it at the top of my lungs as I tromped through the deserted patches of land where the cane fields used to be. Fly, Robin, fly, up, up to the sky. I could hardly contain myself. This is Louise Mancuso for Mind's Eye Radio.
That's our show. Thanks for listening to Mind's Eye Radio's Kindling the Spirit of Fire. Our show comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin. Kelly Warren is our producer with help from Dick Radke. Contributing writers include Jeff Black, Esther Cameron, Louise Mancuso, Kathy Miner, Norma Gay Pruitt, Dick Radke, Fran Rawl, Lynn Patrick Smith, Elena Tabachnik, Evie Thompson, Guy Thurvaldson, Sharon Van Sluice, and Kelly Warren. Original music by Barbara Chusett. Until next time, best wishes from Mind's Eye Radio.